So also, we, as we welcome the dawn, again, we welcome Amina and Perron and Alima. May God bless you, illuminate you, and make you fruitful in his cause, in his service. Amen. Earlier this week, Cabri and I were visiting. It happened to be my birthday, as some of you know, and she shared with me, she studies in the morning from the collective works of the Nayak Khan, and she read to me that morning of my birthday a beautiful passage that relates to the purification breath. And I asked her as a gift to all of us if she would read that passage today before we do the practice of the purification breath. Would you do that? You have such a beautiful voice. It would be a great present to all of us.
In meditation, the control over mind is exerted through breath and mind. The breath is kept rhythmical and refined, and it becomes ever more refined as the consciousness is turned upon it and the light of man's inner being manifests thereon. If the breath is not kept in rhythm, thoughts will enter, and this battle against thought, especially against ego thought, is the battle that every saint and sage has to combat continually. For this also, willpower is needed. So in Sufism, the student is given a symbolical concentration in order to strengthen the willpower, so that not only will this power manifest, but that it can be used to control one's lower nature. When the breath is kept in rhythm and is refined, the magnetism which is ordinarily consumed in the activities of mind and the magnetism which is ordinarily consumed in the activities of body and mind is preserved. In whatever we do and in all our thinking and imagining, we consume energy. This consumption of energy brings on old age and weakness. Contrarywise, it may be that meditation of itself may cure man's evils, whatsoever they be, for all arise out of ego, and meditation is the best means to crush ego. When one does that, the magnetism which is ordinarily wasted or consumed is absorbed into one's personal atmosphere. This makes of him a battery of life. It is this battery which is used by teachers and healers and all mystics. It is the same energy which is mentioned in Nayaz, that it comes to man through the rays of the sun and the waves of the air and the all-pervading power of space. Through breathing, the energy which is conveyed on the air enters the personality through the breath. By silence, and by stilling the mind, one draws upon the endless resources of space. This absorption is a veritable alchemy, and the knowledge of it is the secret of the adept.
So that beautiful reading gives us, again, further insight into the purpose, function, esoteric, metaphysical dimension of the purification breaths. It helps us to develop mastery. It helps us to control the ego. It helps us to build magnetism. These breaths help us draw sustenance from the atmosphere and also to radiate back into the atmosphere. Pyar Mrshidanayak Khan, in some of the last collective interviews before he left for India the last time, gave very clear instructions about practices. And the purifications that he gave and the instructions that he gave in that paper, actually called Practices, Instructions on Practices, he gave the purification breaths in this way. I do want to make a point of saying that I've made some inquiries about this to people that also remember Murshid's brothers and his cousin that carried the lineage onwards after his departure. And I have asked, do you remember this practice being transmitted to you? And the elders that are still alive and remember it say yes. It is exactly that way that this practice came to us through the brothers, through the companions, and the cousin of an icon. The practice is this, and it follows a pattern that will be familiar to all of you. We breathe in the nose and out the nose. Mrshid tells us in a very relaxed, natural way, slightly fuller than one's normal breath. So there's real concentration that goes in the breath, which helps to develop mastery. And the phrase that Mrshid gave us, Hazaradanai Khan gave us, was this: I inhale divine light and life, and I radiate divine life and light as you breathe out. So on the first phrase, the words are light, L-I-G-H-T, and life, L-I-F-E. And as you breathe out, the words become light, L-I-G-H-T, excuse me, life, L-I-F-E, and light, L-I-G-H-T. Now, Mrshid also talks about our concentration is on the breath, and simultaneously, it's as if we're drawing in this light and life from the atmosphere. And when we breathe out, we're radiating it. And he says, what is more, we're breathing in light and life, and we feel love being absorbed into our being. And when we breathe out, we radiate all these things back, holding nothing for ourselves, just being an open channel of receiving and giving. So for the first series of breaths, we breathe in the nose and out the nose while concentrating on those phrases. I inhale divine light and life, and breathing out, I radiate divine life and light. The next breath is in the nose and out the mouth. Inhaling the phrase again. I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. While also absorbing light, life, and love. And radiating the same. Breath changes. It changes in direction, and it changes by breathing in the mouth and out the nose. In the mouth and out the nose. I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. last and final breath of this series is in the mouth, breathing in the mouth and out the mouth, while continuing to repeat the phrase inwardly, I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. And now we let the practice just go, and God willing, we'll be able to be in a state of ease. And one may ask, why didn't Rishabh give this practice? And why was it something so fundamental in the instructions that he asked that this practice be done daily? One can logically say one cleans one's home regularly, one bathes one's body regularly. One, therefore, can take great care at the subtle levels of the being, all levels of the being, to also cleanse those levels. And so the breath is an inner ablution that can help to clarify and revivify and heal, bring into balance and wholesomeness. This practice does that. In a way, it can help us get back to that original natural state. We will be sure to note all the references to the materials that were read during class, so be assured of that. You'll find it online when Cabrilla, you'll post the information for us. I know you always do, and I thank you so much for that. I know other people deeply appreciate your efforts. I'll just take a moment to ask if there are any questions or comments, even, of your own experience.
I'm wondering, the rishis had an ancient technique where when they first awakened in the morning, they would gaze at their palms of their hands, and what did they do before they rubbed their hands on their face? Do you know what it is they do when they look at their palms? No? And the other question I have is, the Buddha, his palm has the two X's in it. I'm wondering how, if there's a path we can do to get X's in our palms. Obviously, that's why we're here, right?
Well, I think that also this is a beautiful and sensitive area where we can absorb things from the atmosphere like we did in the morning, okay. In the beginning of the session, excuse me. And you said in the morning the rishis do that, absorbing. Okay. Yeah. And then also, I believe, and you maybe have another source, Diane, but I believe what I've read is that the Buddha had the Dharma wheel, which would have been an eight-spoked wheel in
right.
the palm of his hand.
Right, and but it's made of axes
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so that was, it represents the Eightfold Path.
Okay.
And we maybe don't have that external sign.
Yeah, you have it. It's just some are deeper yeah. than others.
Yeah. And what we really are searching for is just good heart.
And oneness.
And oneness, unity.
Yeah.
Hazar Nai Khan often said that in unity there is no separation of time and space.
Great.
And we are one. So thank you for your questions. Yes.
Amina, would you like to turn on your microphone?
Hello.
Hello.
The concept of inhaling and exhaling love was a bit awkward for me. I hadn't thought of love being accessible that way, just breathing it in the air.
Yes.
That was my comment.
Keep at it. See what happens. I know you're familiar with this practice and you've been doing it for some time, Amina. See what happens when you add this element to it, okay?
Okay, I'll do that.
All right, love you. Thank you.
Love you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Shall I go on?
Please.
Okay. The main teaching for today is from, it's a continuation on the same subject that we've been on for quite some time from the Gathas, on the subject of training the ego. And here Murshid addresses in this teaching the three parts of the ego. It's an interesting teaching because it may appear, what I'm going to say this at the beginning. Try to suspend all judgment and just remain open. I think this is one of the teachings of Murshid's that could appear on the surface to be paradoxical, but to me, the spiritual path is. We are often searching to reconcile those things which appear to be irreconcilable in our search for unity and wholesomeness. And the paradoxes are what make life rich. Not everything is this or that. It is often this and that. So this teaching is a little bit like that. And so by the time we get to the end, I think it'll be clearer. Again, we'll give the reference online if people wish to go read the teaching a little further. And if there's something that I can do along the way in terms of offering commentary to help, I will. Not that I can, but perhaps something will arise in the moment. So again, Gathas on moral culture, training the ego, the three parts of the ego. The ego is divided into three parts. The physical ego, the mental ego, and the spiritual ego. The mental ego covers the spiritual ego, and the physical ego is a cover over the mental ego. This is almost like those little Russian dolls, right? Where you see one inside of the other. This is a wonderful picture that we could use. The ego indeed is one, but these are three different aspects of the ego. And I might say here that I do believe that there's a connection to this, to doing the breaths in the different directions that touch the different parts of our being. So I'd like to draw your attention to that. And we've had that question before, maybe even last class, where I was maybe talking about the elemental breaths, that one touches the physical, one touches the emotional, one touches the appetites or the passions, one touches the spiritual. And so these are a way of also helping to clear those channels and offer clarification and purification. Murchet goes on to say, the physical ego is nourished by the gratification of the bodily appetites. One sees that after a meal or some refreshing drink of sort, a feeling of stimulation arises. And no doubt it covers, with an additional cover, the eye within. So it's almost like it becomes a distraction. I know I do that all the time, and I know some of us will be going to dinner later, and we're going to be going, this is good. And when we do that, it's a slight distraction. It's stimulating a part of the being. Halima?
Well, I think it's a way of saying thank you.
Absolutely.
We're in this form. I mean, that's whatever.
It is. It's true. And it's all part of it. And it's all connected, because he says, indeed, it's all one. Yeah. Be mindful of it may be helpful. Mindful of it, yeah. So one sees that after a meal or some refreshing drink of sort, a feeling of stimulation arises. And no doubt it covers, with an additional cover, the eye within. And therefore, there is a difference, he's making a big leap here, between sleep and meditation. It's a huge leap. And therefore, there is a difference between sleep and meditation. Although both produce rest, yet one rest is caused by stimulation of the body. Here he's talking about sleep. And the other rest comes without it. There he's talking about meditation. There have been cases of meditative people sleeping only 2 or 3 hours out of the 24 without becoming ill. We've read those stories of the great yogis. And also, I might say, we're not, we haven't taken up that path. Murshid never told us to take up that path of being an ascetic, really. He said to do this practice as part of life, that it is in life that we find our fulfillment, and by being part of a brotherhood, sisterhood, is where we find our realization, although times of retreat are also a benefit. But it causes a stress on the body to overstimulate it. We know that. Okay. Again, there have been cases of meditative people sleeping only 2 or 3 hours out of the 24 without becoming ill. A person who can sleep well shows the signs of health and yet is subject to any illness. The gratification of every appetite is a momentary stimulation and rest to the body. But this momentary satisfaction creates a further appetite. And every experience in the satisfaction of the appetites gives a desire for more satisfaction. It's a kind of addiction that he's talking about. And that might be many things. We know that many... it can be something also wonderful. But still, it can create perhaps an unhealthy attachment in the end, or an obsession even, for some people. Thus the ego, the cover over one's mental, and spiritual being. So here he's referring ego to the physical. Thus the ego, so we could read, thus the physical ego, the cover over one's mental and spiritual being, becomes thicker and thicker until it closes all light from within. It's interesting because I hear it in our everyday language, at least in America's American slang. Oh, they're so dense. Do you know? It's kind of that expression. And we see it sometimes in people. We can see a lightness in some people, and we see a heaviness in other people.
Dense?
Thickness. Like maybe a callousness even. It's another way, but it's thickness.
Yes. The darkness does not understand the light.
Here we go. There, and we've heard this, there are some who eat in order to live, but there are many who live in order to eat. And we find this is true. All of us do. Sometimes if there's an emotion that's unchecked, we'll sometimes satisfy it with some good-tasting food. And we know that there are some comfort foods that we like that satisfy us momentarily. A lot of times we women are very much regretted afterwards. We think, oh my gosh, what will be the consequences of that? At least in America, again, American culture, skinny, athletic body type. Okay. There are some who eat in order to live, but there are many who live in order to eat. The body is an instrument, as Halima said. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. But if the whole life is devoted to the instrument, then the person to whom the instrument exists is deprived of his life or of his experience in life. I'll read that again. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. We do have to have the spirit vehicle. This is the embodiment of the soul. But if the whole life is devoted to the instrument, then the person for whom the instrument exists is deprived of his experience in life, or one could say his soul's experience in this life. Mershad has a beautiful teaching on the privilege of being a human being. And in most traditions, they will tell you the highest, greatest incarnation is that of being a human being. How far do I go back?
About six words, seven.
The highest incarnation is that of being a human being. And one may say, why is that? It's interesting. It's a kind of, again using Mershad's words, it's the dance of the soul. You see, we human beings have free will, and they have a sense of divine will at the same time. There's work to be done when that soul gets incarnated. And I think it's our search to align our free will with the divine will that is the path. It's finding that alignment, that attunement. Did that help, Nora?
Very much.
Okay. Thank you. Back to the teaching. The blindness that the physical ego causes can be clearly seen among the lower creatures. How the lion is inclined to fight with another lion. We have to close our hound dog's ears on this next statement. Mm-hmm. Leo, this doesn't mean you, although we've seen you do it too. How the dog is inclined to watch the bone off which it has already eaten the flesh. Yet it doesn't want another dog to touch it. Isn't it true? It's true. We do that too. Leo, the coonhound, has just put his head down and covered his eyes with his paw in disgrace for the whole species. It's like, I've done it. We all have, Leo. We've all done it, Leo. We've all done it.
It's that funny.
He's so great. Yeah, there are things that we no longer even want, but in a way we don't want someone else to take that up. It's very odd. We have to watch that in ourselves. That kind of envy or competition, which isn't healthy for us, it's harmful. The same physical ego gives man pride in his strength, in his beauty, in his power, in his possessions. If there is a spark of light in time, it must expand to a shining star. Nur al-Anwar, Nur, these are my words, not Mercia's, but the shining star. Nur al-Anwar, the light upon lights. Sufis understand this very well, and they connect with this infinite light. Again, Mercia, I inhale divine light and light. The light upon lights. So he says here, if there is a spark of light in time, it must expand to a shining star. Rumi talks about that, dancing with the stars. Feeling, Pythagoras also talked about it, the symphony of the spheres. This hum, humza. This great oneness. If there is a spark of light in time, it must expand to a shining star. And when there is the slightest darkness, that darkness must expand and put the whole life in a mist. Mist. So here, Mercia, this is a very potent teaching, saying that if we concentrate on the light, all becomes light. But if we concentrate on the darkness too will expand and put our whole life in darkness and in a mist. We can't see clearly. We have no insight. We're blinded in some way. Mershid goes on. In the intoxication of the physical ego, man becomes so interested in the satisfaction of his appetites, only that he can readily harm or injure or hurt not only his enemy, but his dearest friend. In the intoxication of the physical ego, man becomes so interested in the satisfaction of his appetites, only that he can readily harm or injure or hurt not only his enemy, but his dearest friend. As a drunken man does not know what he says or does, so a person blinded with his physical ego is intoxicated and can easily say or do things regardless of the pleasure, comfort, happiness, harmony, or peace of others. And we know all too well how each one of us, we know what it is like to overindulge in some way and have regret, or to have lost control in some way, said something that we know has hurt someone, or did something that hurt someone. And if we have any sense about us, we have regret about that. But at the same time, it does really no good to hang on to that and bring punishment upon myself, yourself. But it is helpful if at that moment we can make a commitment not to do it again. Then we've learned something. Something wonderful can emerge from that. And so for a moment, a few moments, let's take up this practice. This is I think most of you know that Hazrat Inayat Khan gave phrases to his students in English on the swing of the breath. And there was a notebook that was discovered in his own handwriting of a collection of about 300 of these practices. And this is one of them. And I thought that it would be beautiful to share. And it's relevant to this teaching. Is there a question?
Yes, Alina, go ahead and turn your microphone on.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
While you mentioned on the example of the door, that envy could be a good force, right?
You mentioned in the example of the dog that envy can be a good force. Is that correct?
No, I did not say that. I'm glad you're asking the question.
Okay.
No.
Then I will mute my microphone again.
I bet I am curious how you interpreted that.
Right now or another time?
No, I would like to ask the people in the group here, or even online, what you heard me say. You see, I have to tell you, let me clarify it, because sometimes I slip into another modality, and one modality is very, we have classifications and codification of this is good and this is bad. And these emotions we should try to avoid, and these we should try to infuse our being with it. But at one level, and I feel this is very important for us to all understand, if not just now, just conceptually, if you can hear these words, we live in a world where we use words, we use symbols, and we assign meaning and value. But at one level, it is only energy. The energy going through a wire, if I touch it, can kill me. But that same energy can light the house. Does that mean it's a bad energy or a good energy or just energy? Do you understand?
Yes.
So the energy of any of these emotions can be used as pure energy to transform our being.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we hold on to envy. The fact is that envy, if you think of the word even, it makes you feel not so good. That tells you that it's not wholesome. And then we say to ourselves, if there's any good purpose in envy and the feeling that arises in us, it's that it indicates to us that we would rather not feel that way, and therefore we can change our heart and mind about things. And how do we do that? We do that through the practice of generosity. We overcome anger through the act of compassion. All of these emotions have another aspect, light and shadow, light and shadow. We overcome hate with love. You understand?
Yes.
Is it clear now?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that question, and I'm so glad that you wouldn't leave this class with that misconception. Thank you, Alima, for asking for clarification.
You're very welcome.
Love you.